I've always dreamed of being able to order my coffee in Italian like a local, instead of just pointing at the menu and hoping for the best. There's something about speaking another language with real confidence that opens up a whole new world of experiences. That's why I'm so excited about Rosetta Stone Sapphire. It's their biggest launch in over a decade. It takes that research-backed method we all know and trust and adds fresh, cutting-edge features that make it easier than ever to go from knowing a few phrases to speaking naturally about the topics you actually care about. What I love is that you aren't just memorizing vocabulary lists. You learn entirely in your new language through visuals and audio, just like you did as a kid. One of my favorite new features is chat missions. It turns conversation practice into a game, putting you in real-world scenarios, like ordering at a restaurant or asking for directions, and giving you missions to complete. You get real-time feedback along the way, so you build that confidence before you ever have to use your skills in the real world. If you want to take your language skills to the next level, don't wait to try Rosetta Stone Sapphire. Listeners of this podcast can get 20% off their Rosetta Stone Sapphire subscription when they sign up today. This gets you access to Rosetta Stone Sapphire in 25 languages. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10 to redeem your 20% off. That's rosettastone.com/rs10.
The GLP-1 pill you've been waiting for is now on Row. Yep, it's finally here. With the same clinically proven ingredient, now in a pill, and now on Row. It's the first FDA-approved GLP-1 pill for weight loss. At the lowest price available, that's one daily GLP-1 pill for big results. Now on Row. Go to row.co/listen to see if you qualify. Rx only. Go to row.co/safety for serious side effects and boxed warning associated with GLP-1s.
This summer, I'm taking a new approach to styling the smallest spaces in my house with help from Bob's Discount Furniture. Bob's has the small space solutions that America's waited 250 years for, like retro chic bedroom sets with plenty of storage, dinner party ready dining sets in 4 fun colors, stylish spacious Bobopedic sofas, and feature packed power recliners that let me kick back in even the smallest rooms. Plus, I know that Bob's styles are backed by thousands of real 5-star customer reviews, so I can trust that the furniture that I'm getting is not just affordable, but built to last. And the best part? Bob's Furniture ships fast, so I can enjoy my new styles all summer long. So when you're ready to ditch the furniture you're not excited about for the latest trends in small space styling, stop in or shop online at Bob's Discount Furniture, where America shops for furniture.
Hello and welcome to the Deep Dives podcast here on the No Ceilings NBA podcast feed. I am your host, Nick Agar Johnson. And once again, back in the building, my former co-host, now, I guess, tied for most frequent guest this season, which is weird. Usually you avoid me until like February for these, but Tyler Metcalf's back. Tyler, how are you doing this fine evening?
I'm fantastic. You know, new season, you know, figured let's mix it up a little bit and talk hoops almost as regularly, at least recorded as we used to.
Leave the Alper and Şengün spite in the past, right?
Okay,
future Hall of Famer Alper and Şengün.
Okay, see, you're just devolving. You're living in the past, Nick. Move on.
See, this is why I got to throw things off the rail within the first minute, right? Because otherwise, we actually talk about basketball instead of just,
how
you know, unbelievable. All right, let's actually talk about basketball, despite my sarcastic comment. And we're going to talk about your most recent piece over at NoCeilingsNBA.com. So I had a couple of sort of more nebulous questions before we sort of dive into the specifics. I promise I can speak English, but why don't we start with sort of the most basic question that you've heard from me many, many times before. What was it that made you decide to write about Cam Jones for this piece?
I mean, simply put, he's been freaking awesome this year. I mean, when you just look at the numbers, the scoring efficiency is through the roof, like it kind of always has been. He's always like his worst year, like I think was his freshman year, and his effective field goal rate was like in the high 50s, and it's just gotten better every single year. Not dramatically, but when you're that high already, you know, there's not a whole lot more of room to go up, but yet he kind of keeps doing it. And I was kind of skeptical on him last year. It's like, yeah, he's fun, like he can shoot, he can score, he's playing off of Kolek and Iguodaro really well, but it's like, eh, is he really 6'5", first of all? And what, like, a spark plug 6'5", below the rim finisher score doesn't really inspire me a whole lot. And then this year is like, all right, the show is yours. Like, run it. It's all yours. Have at it. And he's performing at an astronomical level. And it's really the playmaking efficiency where the turnover rate continues to drop. And now that he is the guy, the main point guard, the main offensive engine, the assist rate and assist numbers have gone through the freaking roof to, like, historically good levels.
So I did want to touch on some of what you just mentioned, because there's a very sort of, again, this is the nebulous thing that I was talking about before, which I've been thinking a lot this draft cycle about something that's come up from a variety of different reasons. One of the main ones being our own Maxwell Baumbach writing about the sort of dearth of small guards and how much harder it is to be a small guard in modern NBA. And, you know, I've been... It's funny, this is just sort of the way I am, but I feel like I tend to focus a lot more on my draft misses than my draft successes, despite my Alperen Şengün bit at the beginning of the podcast. And Cam Thomas was one of the big ones for me, where I basically had a sort of point where I was like, I can't drop him out of the first round, but I had him at 30 for, like, a significant portion of the back half of that draft cycle, because I was like, okay, he's a prodigious scorer, but can he do enough else? And also, is the scoring going to be efficient enough to sort of have it be valuable to have Cam Thomas shoot enough times to score 20 points a game? And the answer pretty quickly proved to be yes, you idiot. He's one of the best scorers ever. He's Oak Hill's all-time leading scorer, for God's sake. He can put the ball in the basket. But, you know, with someone like Cam Jones, it's a bit different, because, you know, these sort of questions that I had about the Cam Thomas archetype, right? It's a similar sort of deal. And it's funny, because I was talking about this with Tyler Rucker earlier, sort of in exact contrast to this, of the difference between someone like Cam Thomas and someone like Ace Bailey. And there's a whole world of difference between being that kind of shot maker at 6'10 versus at 6'3, right? And, you know, Cam Jones, again, depending on where he's listed, 6'5, generous, 6'4 at Sports Reference, probably closer to the mark, but either way, not exactly someone who, you know, is going to be your Dylan Harper, your Cade Cunningham, right? Like, your point guard with real size. And for Cam, before this year, the question was even how much of a point guard can he be? And that, I think, really opens up the evaluation where, you know, looking at him over the past couple of seasons, there were a couple of things that really stood out to me positively. I mean, the scoring efficiency is, you know, a big one, especially for a guard of his size. But really, for me, what it sort of came down to was, okay, you know, if you're not running the offense through him, is he good enough defensively to essentially just be like a smaller 3-and-D guard type? And, you know, I had enough questions about that that I wasn't quite as willing to buy in. And as you mentioned, this year he's made the leap from, you know, tertiary playmaker to, you know, near records, right, with his assist rate. And it's the kind of development that I think really changes sort of the trajectory of where I view him as a prospect, because all of a sudden it's not just, okay, he's a smaller guard that maybe doesn't create enough for others, right? Now it's, you look at the whole package and it looks a whole lot more appealing when he makes teams pay with his passing and with his scoring.
So, and the tricky thing with him is that this is, like, the first year that we've gotten that real playmaking consistency from him. And it's an important, really, really important data point, because I'm, like, right now his assist rate's up to, like, 42 and his turnover rate's sub 10. And it's all on a usage rate that's really similar to what it was last year when he was a scorer, you know, an outlet, a spot up shooter, someone who could occasionally, you know, run a second side pick and roll and play some backup point guard. So the fact that his usage is still the same and the playmaking efficiency has gone to astronomical and historic levels, where the combination of assist and turnover rate that he currently has, no one in, you know, Bartorvik's database that goes back to 2008 has ever reached. Doing that on high efficiency with zero drop off in scoring efficiency, it's tough to look at it and not be really encouraged and really impressed. And it's like, yeah, I wish he was really explosive. I wish he had a 40-inch vertical. I wish that he was 6'7". I wish that he was, you know, 220. But he's not. And, you know, those things will put kind of a cap on what he will likely become, what his ultimate career outlook likely will be. But man, when you look at what he can do and what he is doing and what he's done year over year, it just screams versatility and efficiency. And when you, at a base level, I mean, what else can you really ask for from a guard? It's like, yeah, I wish, you know, yeah, he's a little smaller. Yeah, he's a little older. I don't really care, though, because we have 4 years now and a really substantial track record of him doing so many different things at about as high of a level as you could possibly ask him to do.
That's, I think, really the thing for me is that, you know, you can continue to sort of, you know, look for nits to pick. But really, for me, again, the big question was just, can he, you know, create enough plays for others that the rest of his game can shine? And I mean, you brought up the efficiency. He's, as you mentioned, you know, his freshman year, 56% effective field goal percentage. Sophomore year, 58%. Junior year, 60%. This year, 64% so far. And there's one, it's insane. And, you know, some of the synergy percentiles that you have in the piece, which by the time you're listening to this, he will have played either one or two more games since Metcalf wrote the article. So any discrepancies there are entirely not due to him making a mistake in the writing or me making a mistake in the editing. It's all due to those additional games. And if you can prove otherwise, no, you can't. You're wrong. But anyway, I think, you know, one of the things that really stands out to me is something that I look at a lot for smaller guards, you know, and this is not exactly an uncommon thing, right? But the finishing numbers. Mm-hmm. And Cam Jones is shooting 65% on two-pointers right now.
Yeah.
Those are big men. Like, I'm so...
And, like, all of those shots are at the rim, too.
He's taken
maybe one. I think when I wrote the piece, he took one mid-range jumper on the year. Everything is from three or at the rim. And, I mean, I think including transition, he was above 70% at the rim and just under that in the half court. That is ridiculous for someone who has zero dunks.
And, you know, it's that, but also that, you know, because he's made this big leap forward in terms of his pick and roll playmaking, right? There's only so dangerous your pick and roll playmaking can be if teams are, you know, sort of playing toward the shot, right? Like with Cam Jones, you know, again, someone who as of right now is at 40%+ from three for the second consecutive year. And, you know, that's his freshman year, he shot 39%, right? So it's not like, you know, he had, you know, some dramatic shooting growth. As you mentioned, he's always been this level of shooter, right? But the, you know, the pick and roll playmaking can only be so dangerous when teams go either direction, right? The example that I sort of always use with this is Rajon Rondo in his year with the Kings, where he led the league in assists. He shot 37% from three-point range. It was on two attempts per game, and like pretty much every single one of those attempts was wide open because teams knew Rajon Rondo is going to be hunting the, you know, kick out assist. He's not going to be looking to score at all for himself. And also, if he is going to score at all, it's going to be around the basket. So we can just completely abandon him beyond the 3-point line, to the point where, you know, that 37% mark looks pretty on the surface, but dig just even the tiniest little bit beneath that and you realize, oh, this is actually because he can't shoot and they're just leaving him wide open shots that, like, most NBA players will hit higher than 37% on wide open 3-pointers, right? But with Cam, the, you know, part of the problem is because he's so ridiculously good around the rim, as you mentioned, without those dunks, right? Without that next level sort of athleticism, that's the kind of craft as well that you can expect to translate rather than just, you know, the flip side is someone like, say, I always go back to Cliff Alexander, who was, you know, top five recruit coming out of high school, ridiculously athletic, gets to the point where he's not just dunking on 6'3 centers and it doesn't quite work as well, right? That's almost the exact opposite of what Cam Jones is. And it makes it a lot easier to sort of buy into the fact that, yeah, you know, maybe he won't be this ludicrously efficient at the next level, but he'll definitely be able to convert baskets at the rim at a high level.
Baseball fans, think you know who's hitting a homer today? Well, FanDuel is giving you a free chance to call your shot with daily dingers. Joining the action is easy. Just make your free pick on who's hitting a home run in their game, and if you're right, you'll get a profit boost to use on your next bet for a chance at extra winnings. You've got nothing to lose and a lot to gain. And don't forget, you can make a free pick every day during the MLB season. It's just another reason why FanDuel is the home for home runs. So, are you ready to play your game today? Join all the action at FanDuel.com/podcast. That's FanDuel.com/podcast to play daily dingers and make your free pick on who's hitting a homer. Play ball and swing for the fences on FanDuel, an official partner of the MLB.
Must be 21 plus and present in Ohio. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. A bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Yeah, and so I just double checked, and in per Synergy, our friends at Synergy do great work. 52% of his shots in the half court are coming at the rim, and he's shooting 69%. He has taken zero mid range jump shots this year. So I know the there's a whole lot of discourse about the shot selection in the NBA, and are there too many threes and whatever. But I think what that kind of distribution for Cam Jones speaks to is how effortless that translation to the NBA and the NBA system should be for him. Because the mid-range is alive and well for superstars. It is a select range where a select few can live and thrive. And Cam Jones is not going to be one of those guys. And that's okay, because he is incredibly efficient and one of the most efficient players in the country at the two spots where he will be taking those shots. And that's at the rim, and that's from three, where, you know, is he going to shoot 69% at the rim in the NBA? Probably not. But that downturn, that drop off, is going to be a lot less severe. Even if it's 10 percentage points, he's up around 60% at the rim in the half court for a below the rim finisher. That's insane. There's always some sort of drop off, and the year-over-year efficiency and consistency and versatility with how he's protecting the ball around the rim, the different angles he's finishing at, the way that he throws it high off the glass or sneaks it in before the shot blocker can rotate over. There's so much craft and versatility and patience with it, where it's like, yeah, there's going to be some drop-off. There inevitably is, but I'm really not worried about it because we have so much data that tells us how elite he is at doing these things.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, there's going to be a drop off for everybody, but when you start as high up the mountaintops, you've got a lot more room.
Right. Your drop off from elite to the NBA is like, oh, he's still very good. It's like, okay, awesome. That I can deal with that. A drop off from 70% to 65% is a lot different than 60 to 55%.
Yes. And, you know, I think with the mid-range stuff, you hit the nail on the head there too. But, you know, I think the thing to note is, and this is funny because I'm remembering conversations that you and I had in the past about Jaden Ivey and how important it was that he figure out something in mid-range game. But that was because he was a projected top five pick who was, you know, expected to be a potential superstar, right? You know, Cam Jones, much though we both enjoy watching him play basketball, is probably not going to be a top five pick in this year's draft, and therefore is probably not going to have top five pick expectations, which is, again, where that mid-range game comes into play, right? Of, you know, if you're DeMar DeRozan, yeah, teams are going to be perfectly happy to let you get a bunch of mid-range jumpers because you're shooting 50% on them and you're making defenses have to actually pay attention to that area of the court rather than just funneling as many shots there as they can get away with, right? Those aren't going to be the shots that you want Cam Jones to take. So the fact that, you know, he's not shown that at this, you know, this season is totally fine. Because again, as you said, those aren't the shots that teams will hope for him to take at the next level.
Yeah, it's all about playing your role, playing to your strengths, and adapting and being malleable for so many players. Like, yeah, it'd be incredible. I would love if Cam Jones turns into an MVP caliber player.
Yeah, it'd be fun.
The odds are against it. So what does that mean? So it's all right. So let's play like a role player in the NBA will play. And that's what he's doing. But it's at a superstar level in college on a major program going against really high level competition consistently. And he's just carving them up game after game.
So I'm going to pull a couple of sections from the piece here. And, you know, you essentially talk about something that we started out talking about. I'm just going to quote you here. The label of combo guard can be a tricky one. Typically, it's used as just an easy way to label undersized shooting guards or bigger point guards who can't really shoot. And that's the thing is, now that Cam Jones has, you know, developed to this point as a passer, because I think it's a combination of things, right? I think it's both that the opportunity has expanded, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there's only so many possessions that you want Cam Jones to be the hub of your offense when you have Oso Iguodala and Tyler Kolek, right? It's a different story this year. And so I think there's genuine improvement there. I think there's also increased opportunity. But, you know, let's just for fun read through some of the efficiency numbers. So again, you know, caveat from before, it's a game or two games out of date, but 96th percentile as a pick and roll scorer, 62nd percentile spotting up, 97th percentile in transition, 78th percentile on handoffs, 89th percentile as a jump shooter, 95th percentile specifically shooting off the catch, 56th percentile shooting off the dribble, 85th percentile at the rim. And both of the numbers that sounded lower than the rest were in the 87th percentile last year as a spot-up shooter and in the 97th percent shooting off the dribble last year. So, yeah, it's really hard to find sort of an area in terms of shooting efficiency that isn't a huge positive in Cam Jones' corner.
Yeah, and it's like those two drop-offs in pull-up shooting and spot-up. It's like, okay, well, you have a lot more on your plate. Both on both ends of the floor. Whereas like I wouldn't classify him as necessarily a good defender, but I think it's gotten a lot better. But just on offense, when you have the ball in your hands that often, when you're having to bring it up the court every single time and you're facing full court pressure some of the time, it wears on your legs and those numbers are bound to drop off. They're still really good though. And they're still well above average. And again, that drop off was from elite the year before. So when we think about him translating to the NBA, he's continuing to show us that he has so much versatility and efficiency in his game, where if a team's like, hey, we have this kind of jumbo creator, wing creator, we need you to be more of a spot up scorer, second side creator, it's like, all right, cool, I thrived at doing that. Or if they're like, hey, we have a ton of play finishers and we just kind of need you to facilitate and run the show and pick your spots and keep the offense flowing, it's like, all right, fantastic, I've been incredible at that all year. So it's just whatever kind of guard role he's gonna need to fill, he's showing us time and time again that there aren't that many players in the country more ready for that.
And you know, I think the track record is a big one. And as I've mentioned before, you know, I always feel mean sort of bringing out the Derek Williams principle of it. But, you know, there's something to be said. And this is why I also have my other corner of the partial free throw truther thing. Right. And that's really the only sort of Cam Jones is almost the exception that proves the rule of my sort of free throw shooting belief, in that, yes, you know, he's just a shade under 70% from the free throw line for his college career. But usually when I'm referencing free throw numbers, it's because, you know, the variance on free throw shooting is much larger, which makes it easier to see who's a good shooter and who isn't. But also the sample size tends to be, you know, if not larger, at least, you know, equivalent with a number that translates slightly better. And with Cam Jones, it's the opposite, because he's taken under 200 free throws for his college career, which, you know, really, if you're going to find a knock with his scoring, I would argue it's, you know, not quite getting to the free throw line at a prodigious rate. But, you know, we look beside that, right? And he shot over 700 three-pointers in his college career, and he's hit 38.5% of them. He's shot 547 two-point attempts, and he's shooting 61% for his college career, right? This isn't just, oh, he's having a breakout year this year, right? You know, the passing, he's having a breakout year. I would be comfortable sitting on that corner, right? But the shooting efficiency, basically, you know, again, everywhere except getting to the free throw line and knocking down free throws at a crazy rate, he has done. And even with the free throws, it's exactly the same story as the effective field goal percentage. He's gone up every year, 61% his freshman year, 66% his sophomore year, 72% last year, 75% so far this year, right? There's really not any sort of shooting efficiency indicator that not only doesn't speak incredibly positively of Cam Jones, but also speaks to, you know, as you talked about already, that consistency, right? It's not just, oh, you know, he got crazy hot. And, you know, 1 year he shot 50% from 3-point range and everybody thinks he's a ridiculous 3-point shooter. And to be clear, that's a Derek Williams reference. That's not a Reed Shepard reference. But, you know, with Cam, again, the history is there with every, you know, scoring element. It's the passing that's taken a leap, but the passing taking a leap makes it a lot easier to imagine NBA teams not necessarily sort of being able to shut him down by saying, okay, you know, we'll let you shoot, or okay, we'll let you get to the rim. We know you can't finish, right? He doesn't have either of those problems. In fact, he's ridiculously gifted in both of those areas.
Yeah, it's the free throw numbers are really bizarre, but I think you summed it up in a really good way where it's like, it's that sample size thing. And you know, what we've been talking about with the shooting efficiency, it's like, it's almost a complete flip side of that. And when you look at his shot distribution, I mean, as a freshman, he took 52 two-point attempts compared to 143 threes. So as a sophomore, 157 to 278. And then last year was when they kind of started to meet out in the middle of 235 to 234. And this year it's 103 to 51 three-point attempts. And year over year, we've seen his free throw rate continue to rise. Now, it's still well below average. It's only at like 21 right now. So it's a big hole in his game. But when we think about the shot distribution, it's like, yeah, no wonder he's not taking any free throws. And, it, you know, every one that you miss with that much lower of a sample size, it's going to skew the results even more. So, but with him, you know, it's like we have 4 years now of elite jump shooting and 4 years of incredible at rim finishing, especially this year when he's running the show, when there's so much more responsibility on his plate. There are a million more decisions that he has to make every single possession and things that he has to process. To not lose any of that efficiency is really, really shocking.
And to do it while, you know, this is an insane number to me, but he's averaging fewer turnovers per 100 possessions?
Yeah.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah. His turnover rate has gone down every year. It's been good. It's been really consistent, but it's somehow gone down this year. Where I, as a freshman, 12.5, as a sophomore, 8.9, as a junior, 10.7, and then this year, 9.7. Every year, the assist rates were 11.9, 12, 16, and now 42. That is insane to not only have that astronomical leap in playmaking rate, which, you know, speaks to how many more passes a game he's making, and somehow making fewer turnovers per possession. It's really, really just bizarre stuff, because even if his turnover rate doubled and jumped to 18 or 20 in terms of turnover rate, not per game, that would be concerning. Per game would be very concerning. Like if his turnover rate jumped to 20 this year, but his assist rate was still up around 40, it'd be like, oh, okay, that's understandable, because look at this different role. Look at the context. And he is this, so far, this statistical outlier where it's like, okay, the passing accuracy, the decision-making is about as perfect as you could possibly ask for.
I mean, he went from like, I'm doing quick math here, so I might be off, but he went from like a 1.7 assist to turnover rate to like a Jones brother-esque 4.92 assist to turnover. Like that's, you know, he went from like, okay, you know, he makes more plays than he gives away, but not, you know, someone who's particularly sterling in terms of his ball control, to like elite, like top of the league level in terms of just not making mistakes. And those two numbers are not numbers that you almost ever see in that sort of pattern. Like to almost triple your assists while cutting down your turnover rate is, again, you know, there are only so many superlatives that we can use to describe something like that, but it's absolutely insane that that's even in the cards for him to be able to do.
Yeah. So just for comparison, let's look at Tyler Kolek's numbers. So his freshman year was at George Mason, so a different team. But his freshman year, assist rate of 14, turnover rate of 16.2. Okay, both average, whatever. Sophomore year at Marquette, assist rate jumps to 33.9. Turnover rate jumps to 24.5. Makes sense. Yeah. That's not an ideal turnover rate, but the assist rate jumping that much, okay, whatever. Junior year, 39.5 assist, 18.5 turnover. Senior year, so last year with that awesome Marquette team, 42.1 assist rate to a turnover rate of 18.9. Cam Jones has almost an identical assist rate and half the turnover rate without Oso Iguodaro.
And doing the primary point guard thing for the first time.
Right. So I'm sorry to sound like a broken record here, but it's just it's shocking. We don't see guys make that type of leap when their decision making is, you know, quadrupled from the year before.
Ready to level up? Chumba Casino is your playbook to fun. It's free to play with no purchase necessary. Enjoy hundreds of online social games like blackjack, slots, and solitaire anytime, anywhere with fresh releases every week. Whether you're at home or on the go, let Chumba Casino bring the excitement to you. Plus, get free daily login bonuses and a free welcome bonus. Join now for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Play Chumba Casino today. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. T&Cs apply.
The first few weeks back at school set the tone for the entire year. But with new teachers, schedules, and expectations, it can feel like a lot. If you're looking to help your child start strong and stay confident, I've been using IXL to make that transition so much easier. IXL is an award-winning online learning platform that helps kids truly understand what they're learning. Whether they're building math confidence, strengthening reading and writing skills, or reviewing science concepts, from pre-K through 12th grade, it adapts to each child's level and pace, making it easy to spot and close learning gaps in just a few minutes a day before those gaps can snowball. Plus, it's trusted nationwide. 1 in 4 students in the U.S. are learning with IXL, and it's used in 96 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. It's an easy, cost-effective way to get kids back into a learning routine and walking into class feeling ready and reassured. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. Listeners can get an exclusive 20% off an IXL membership when they sign up today at IXLlearning.com/audio. Visit IXLlearning.com/audio to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
So I owe you an apology. We are 27 minutes into the podcast and you've only said the word defense once. So I have failed you, but let's try and make up for that and talk about some of the defensive stuff. And look, you mentioned it, you know, he's not going to earn his playing time by being a defensive stopper, yeah. Right? That's not the conception here. But, you know, as I think, first of all, the key point, as you make, his defensive playmaking and all ball footwork here, we said defensive footwork. There you go. Old Deep Dives fans drink. But they're the best they've ever been in college, which you sort of mentioned earlier, sort of in passing. But it's, I don't know, I feel like really he's been okay. There hasn't been, you know, like he's not a defensive playmaker, but, you know, there are good defenders who aren't defensive playmakers. There are bad defenders who aren't defensive playmakers, right? That doesn't necessarily tell you anything. It's more just, hey, you know, if he did have he has a decent block and steal rate, but if he had a slightly better one, right, that's sort of, okay, this is what he hangs his hat on defensively. For me, it's more just that his improved playmaking makes it easier for him to be more of a two-position guy as opposed to just, okay, he's pretty much locked as your off-ball guard, right? And that, you know, opens up a sort of wider avenue for potential players to guard. Now, you know, frankly, the kinds of players that you're going to be guarding as more of an on-ball guard are probably the kinds of players that Cam Jones is going to have more trouble with, right? You know, the crazy quick guys, you know, wild first step, that sort of thing. So he'll probably end up mostly guarding twos anyway. But, you know, again, I'm just like, even if the defense sort of stayed static at like below average, but not killing you, given his change in, you know, playmaking profile, I'm much more comfortable with that than evaluating him last year, where it was like, okay, you know, he's really efficient offensively. He doesn't provide as much when he doesn't have the ball in his hands. What sort of avenues to playing time does he have? And I don't think he's necessarily opened more avenues defensively this year, but just being sort of more comfortably in that he's fine range is really all he needs to do, right? It's not, they don't need him to break out and become this defensive specialist, and he probably won't. But, you know, again, the improvements playmaking wise make it easier for him to fit into more contexts that might be able to cover up for him better defensively.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's a really similar kind of thought process to what we just talked about with what would have been a reasonable turnover rate, where it's like, okay, the offensive responsibilities have increased tenfold, and it naturally some energy is going to be diverted and taken away from other aspects of the game. And I don't see that with his defense. And I, you know, again, he's not an all-league defender or an all-NBA defender or anything like that. But it feels like he kind of continues to steadily improve on the margins and getting to that place of being just good enough and in the right place and just in the way for someone who is that efficient and prolific on the offensive end, I think is more than you could really hope for. And especially in the NBA, when those offensive responsibilities likely come back down a little bit, okay, cool. Maybe there's a little bit more energy that can be diverted to jumping a few more passing lanes, getting a little more aggressive, gambling a little more on defense. But I feel like a lot of the kind of defensive errors that we would see occasionally from him, where he'd get back cut or caught ball watching, or really sloppy fundamentals, or just flat out beat due to a lack of foot speed or something, I feel like those are popping up way, way less than in previous years. So the fact that, again, the offensive responsibility being increased substantially, while also this is the highest steal rate he's had of his career at 3, which again isn't crazy, but it's above average, and it's kind of in that range of that speaks to being an opportunistic defender, being in the right place at the right time, being able to capitalize on a loose handle or an errant pass. And then you watch the film and see how he kind of slides his feet a little more consistently, gets beat less on back cuts, is more active with tagging and recovering. And that's the kind of stuff where it's like, okay, just the game, all of it, every single aspect of the game for this guy has slowed down so much. And it just speaks to kind of just his cerebral approach to the game and how much easier that's gotten for him.
I think I was maybe a bit unfair about the defensive stuff, just because he does have a quite decent steal rate. And I think if you want to sort of look at the total package, the Marquette Wisconsin game, he was everywhere on both ends. I mean, he had 4 steals in that game, in addition to just lights out shooting on top of everything else. I mean, you know, getting to the rim at will, you know, I think that's his most free throws taken in a game this year, was in that Wisconsin game, which, you know, he went to the line 6 times, not exactly James Harden-esque, but, you know,
deep. For like, him, that's living at the line.
Yeah. Well, you know, the difference between, I mean, for him, right, it's like 6 free throw attempts per game is, you know, that would be fantastic when he's at 3. And that's, you know, by far the highest rate of his college career is at 3. But, you know, as you mentioned earlier, right, his sort of shifting away his shot diet from being mostly just a 3-point spot up guy to taking more shots around the rim than from the 3-point line, hopefully that free throw number will tick up. But I mean, yeah, that's really sort of, and it's funny because it came after what was probably his worst game of the season against Iowa State the night before, but, you know, whatever. Even in that Iowa State game, he still had 9 assists, right? But, you know, with all of that sort of putting it together in a total package, that Wisconsin game, I mean, as you mentioned, he bullied them and showed everything that you might want to see from him.
And specifically to that Wisconsin game, what stood out the most was just the effortless dissection of the 2-man game, where every time they ran a pick and roll with him, it was the right decision. And he loves that over that live dribble over the head kind of kickback assist to a pick and pop guy. And after like the 5th or 6th time Marquette knocked down a 3 on that, they shifted up their coverages, and whether they switched or blitzed him or just kind of stuck to their man, he capitalized and manipulated their defensive coverages over and over again and just constantly made the right decision. And that's something that has popped up every single game this year with him on both ends of the floor is just the decision making. He's never taking a step in the wrong direction.
And that's something that, you know, there are some things, right? Like we expect the rim finishing numbers to go down when he reaches the NBA level. Surprise, surprise, that happens for everybody. But one thing that will be better at the NBA level is, you know, and this is mainly just sort of the evolution of the last five or so years of basketball, is the versatility of big men that he's going to have at his disposal, right? Like, you know, rather than like, okay, I guess Ben Gold can put up some threes, right? You know, you're going to have, like, imagine someone like Cam Jones playing with, you know, it's funny because he's not even the best, you know, sort of most versatile big man example, but like him playing with someone like Bam Adebayo, where it's like, oh, all the gravity has to go to him, right? And so, you know, around the basket, right, there's a lot more room that kind of a big man can clear out than, you know, again, like Ben Gold is the only 6'10 player on Marquette who gets minutes, right? And, you know, he's fine, I guess, as a shooter. He's at 34%. But, you know, the versatility of, like, you know, it's cheating to say Nikola Jokic, but sure, why not, right? Like, just, you know, but even if you look down benches, right, you certainly are quite familiar with Naz Reid, right? You know, just it's the kind of thing where, again, for Cam Jones to be this successful with not only a team that lost its two best players last year, but also a team that, you know, can help him, but certainly isn't equipped to sort of provide the tools that most modern NBA teams can provide in terms of their big man rotation. He has a lot more options than just, okay, I'm, you know, going to do the overhead kick out to a 3-point shooter, which is fun, right? But it's not as dangerous as, okay, this is someone who can hurt you in a variety of different ways rather than just, okay, I'm going to finish around the basket or I can be the kick out guy.
Yeah. And it's weird to have any questions with his playmaking given the numbers, but
sure.
So much of his kind of assist game has come in that two-man game where, you know, the pocket passes, lobs over the top, those kickbacks, that's kind of the vast majority of where his assists come from. Occasionally we'll see him find a cutter or, you know, kick out of a drive or something, but that's kind of the next evolution and step that I'm waiting for from him is, okay, if the defense kind of starts consistently sending that low man over and leaving shooters, or, you know, can you consistently read and manipulate and dissect those weak side rotations when teams are making those multiple rotations on the weak side and guys are collapsing from the wing to the corner? Can you read that in time and kick out, or, you know, look off one and pass to the other? That kind of stuff, the second and third level playmaking, we haven't yet seen a ton of. So again, nitpicking here, especially since his role in terms of playmaking will probably be a little more fluid in the NBA, and not as the offensive initiator. But that's something I'm really curious about kind of for the rest of this year and going forward into the future.
And it's something that we've talked about with guards before. I remember it most explicitly with Alondis Williams, but it's sort of and I'm going to massively oversimplify this for the sake of, you know, trying to describe it on a podcast. But, you know, if you sort of think of quote unquote, you know, passing mastery as having, let's call it, again, for the sake of simplicity, three levels. The first level being, can you make the simple read to continue a play offensively, right? Can you be the guy who gets the swing pass on the wing and can kick it to the corner to, you know, get to turn a good shot into a great shot as a mostly off-ball player, right? Like, can you keep an offense flowing? And a surprising number of prospects don't hit that first level even. And then there's sort of the second level, which is, okay, you know, can you run a simple offense? Can you run a two-man game, as you mentioned, right? Can you run a basic pick and roll and not make mistakes? And that's sort of where Cam Jones is. And then there's sort of the third level, which I use Alondis Williams as an example because the comparison that we were making at the time was Alondis Williams versus Iverson Molinar. As someone who, Iverson Molinar always made the right decision,
yeah,
but he wasn't making home run passes. Alondis Williams would sometimes throw the ball into the 13th row, but other times it would be, you know, a 70-foot like cross-court dime in transition that turns a play that would have been a half-court play into an easy transition bucket, right? And that's sort of the quote-unquote final level of the passing mastery of, it's not just can you see where the easy looks are, like, you know, where sort of the next step is in the offense and, you know, make that read as the primary playmaker rather than just keeping the ball moving, or are you at the level passing wise that you're creating openings that would not have been there without the pass? And that's obviously by far the hardest level to hit, right? But, you know, the fact that Cam Jones has essentially mastered level two of that after, you know, questions heading into the year of, okay, you know, he's probably got level one, but do we have any sort of, you know, primary playmaking element right now? It's okay, can he get to the point where he's creating looks with his passes rather than finding the looks and hitting those passes, right? But not creating something out of nothing in a way that, you know, the most sort of superlative passers at the NBA level can do.
Yeah, it's that ability to kind of manipulate and move defenders. And it's a really, really difficult skill to develop and grow into. But it's that difference between passing and playmaking, between Tyus Jones and LaMelo Ball, between Cam Jones and Yegor Demon. It's there are just different levels to it. And, you know, some of Cam's current assist and turnover numbers are bonkers and a real testament to his passing accuracy, his growth in that area, and his decision making. But on the flip side of that, they're also a testament to his lack of risk taking, his lack of really pushing it, really trying to pass guys open. And it's more so just taking what the defense gives him, which is really important, especially in his first year in this role. But it also may provide a rather telling kind of ceiling of what his on-ball offensive creation role at the next level can ultimately evolve and grow into.
And, you know, it would be great if he develops that, but I think something else I've been thinking about quite a lot in this draft cycle is just sort of the value of, we know this guy can play, and we know this guy can play at a high level, right? Like, if, you know, if you're selecting Tyus Jones with the third overall pick, you might not be all that happy, but he's already had a career that is better than the average 10th overall pick, right? Yeah. And Cam Jones is probably not going to go in the lottery. Like, you know, I would be surprised if he doesn't go in the first round, but I would also be surprised if he goes, say, 9th. But, you know, even if he goes 9th and has a Tyus Jones career, that is, again, above average for a 9th overall pick. So, you know, there might not be sort of, and, you know, the old pun of no ceilings. Yeah, okay, fine. But you know, the concept of something like that, yeah, you know, maybe Cam Jones doesn't have the sort of all NBA outcomes that a Yegor Demon might have. But if you can be pretty confident that, you know, even the 30th percentile outcome for Cam Jones is like a 9th or 10th man, that's a pretty good player to get at, you know, 17 or 21 or anything in that sort of range in the latter half of the first round.
And it goes back to the importance of kind of scouting these guys for the most likely role that they'll be used in the NBA. And probably Cam Jones is going to be a backup point guard in the NBA for most of his career, maybe fringe starter, depending on how things unfold. But I don't think a team is probably going to draft him being like, all right, cool, we got our franchise starting point guard for the next decade. And that's not a knock on him. It's just, it's an incredibly difficult position to play and to master, and you can make a lot of money as a backup point guard, and a lot of teams wish that they had a better backup point guard right now. So the responsibilities for that backup point guard are typically, hey, just kind of keep the offense flowing, make the right decision, you know, don't lose the game in these minutes. And I almost never have a concern that Cam Jones is going to be out there losing his team the game, because the decision making and scoring efficiency, it's just gotten too good.
All right, anything else you want to say before we wrap this one up?
Nope.
Great. That awkward silence will certainly be shorter in post. There we have it. Thank you to Tyler Metcalf for coming back and enduring me for another 45 minutes. You can find him on Twitter at tmetcalf11, and you can find him on Blue Sky at tylermetcalf.bluesky.social. You can find me on Blue Sky at NBA johnson.bluesky.social. You can find the ghost of my Twitter account on that website as well. But if you're expecting a response, your better bet is Blue Sky. If you have any feedback regarding the deep dives portion of the podcast, feel free to reach out to me either via Blue Sky or email nickaj.nba@gmail.com. And please subscribe to the podcast if you haven't yet and leave a rating and or a review in whatever podcast player you might be using. That's always much appreciated on our end. And as always, thanks so much for listening.
Nerds.
Today's episode is sponsored by NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Personal finance can feel like a pop quiz you didn't study for. This podcast is your study guide. On NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast, you'll hear from trusted journalists who explain the why behind major financial decisions. You'll get research-backed insights and clear pros and cons, whether you're planning a big purchase or just want to grow your wealth. Make your next financial move with confidence. Follow NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast on your favorite podcast app.